With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to Going Off Track.
Hi. How you feeling?
Good.
Yeah.
I feel like I've been podcasting a lot.
And you have.
My jaw is getting tired.
Yeah, I can tell that. You're sitting there with your mouth open.
Do you know what I'm doing after this?
You're not going to yoga because you do that early.
I do that early. I'm going to Amos's place to podcast.
Oh, he's not going to get 100% out of you, man.
No, he's definitely not. It's good. This is for, I have another podcast. Do you mind if I talk about my other podcast?
I would love to hear about it.
I do another podcast called Drifter Sympathy. We've did 2 seasons on Feral Audio, and we're starting to work on some new stuff. And it's basically Emo telling a story from his childhood, which is always insane. And then us talking about it, and then Emo edits in all this music and sound effects.
He spends a ton of time.
Well, Emo's always on tour.
It's like a piece of art.
Yes. It's like a piece of audio art. And yeah. Emo's on the road so much. He just works on, you know, Emo plays Grails, Ohm, Holy Sun, Flats and Champagne. He's in like 19 bands. So he edits these and does them on the road. And then every other episode is kind of like obscure music from that era. Like if you ever see Emo, have you ever seen Emo DJ?
No.
Like when I DJ it, I like bring my like laptop, whatever. When Emo DJs, he brings like actual vinyl records and just crates of them and just this, all this obscure, cool stuff. And it's like, he's like really knows music.
Right.
Like he knows so much more about music than I do. I know a lot about very specific types, but I feel like he really knows a lot. So yeah, so this podcast is really fun, and we record it at his apartment, and he lives near me. And so after this, I'm going to probably drink like my 5th coffee of the day and go over emails and talk about some insane situation. So if that sounds interesting to you, check it out.
Today, Drifter Sympathy, in case you drifted off.
Drifter Sympathy. But today on the podcast, our guest is not Emo Amos, but it is someone else with 2 one-syllable names.
Yeah, 2 four-letter names.
Well, I guess Amos. A similar name. Emo Amos.
John Bush. John's an old pal of mine. I've known him for years, which is pretty apparent.
Not the John Bush from Anthrax.
This John Bush may actually be, as he did bring up, the most interesting man in the world. If that guy from that commercial really existed, this may be him. John's done tons of shit in his life, and he's not afraid to talk about it.
Yes. Yeah, so this podcast, yeah, talks about how he came up, his time touring with the Swingin' Utters and NoFX, his time as a bartender for Me First and the Gimme Gimmes.
His time in Iraq.
Shooting guns. I mean, we really run the whole gamut with John.
He doesn't blow up a cow, just so you
he
know.
He does not.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. We all have to have limits. And we also talk about his career now as a restaurateur.
Yeah, he's blowing up. He's blowing up now.
Yeah. So yeah, John, jiu-jitsu, we talk about a lot of things, which is what this podcast is all about. And yeah, John has been a friend of the podcast, and he just came over to Brad's apartment. It was basically, that's like the whole great thing about this podcast. It's like an excuse to have your friend come over and talk
just
about old
shoot
stories.
Shit and yeah. Eat Girl Scout cookies.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And if you want to eat a Girl Scout cookies, Brad, you get, I'm doing a much better job at this than you are.
I appreciate this. Yes.
Go to goingofftrack.com/cookies. Sounds like I'm lying, but this is an actual link Brad made. And if you go there, you can buy Girl Scout cookies from him and support the Girl Scouts.
Well, they're from my 10-year-old daughter.
Yeah.
And supports the Girl Scouts.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they've got s'mores this year, which are good.
S'mores? What's that?
You know, like s'mores, like.
Yeah. Is the word s'more trademark? They can't call them that?
S'mores. I think they're called s'mores.
Oh, I thought you said.
I don't think you could trademark it because it's three different, like, trademarked products.
I know. I thought you were saying the cookies were called s'mores.
I was trying to add a little, like.
Oh, I thought you were like, legally they can't call them s'mores, but they can call them s'mores.
I was trying to irritate Benny, who's probably not listening.
Yeah, Benny's definitely not listening. But yeah, so do that. Also, if you want to record yourself eating cookies, you should do it at Pulse Music in the highest fidelity possible.
Yeah, even though this particular episode was not recorded there,
yes.
Most of our episodes are, and they're very generous to allow it.
Yes. So. So thanks to Pulse Music, although thanks to Brad for letting us record this one at your house. And thanks to John Bush for coming by and telling all these insane stories. And let's listen to this podcast with John Bush now. Here we are, Brad's apartment.
Hey, this is the first, this is the first actual full podcast we've done.
Yeah,
here,
the first guest we've had at Brad's place.
You feel so special?
Yeah.
Check me out.
It's just me and Brad.
We're sitting here with the legendary John Bush.
John Bush, yeah. How should we introduce you, John?
Oh, man, I don't know. living legend.
Restaurant mogul. Bartender to the gods.
The real most interesting man on the planet.
It's possible.
I got good stories.
You have a lot of stories, and that's why you're here.
Yes.
You would start this podcast, and my mom was just here for Christmas, and she was telling a very funny story about when I was like 10 years old, and my mom was like, "What do you want to do when you grow up?" And I said, "I don't want to be boring."
You've accomplished it.
I know. I think I did.
So when did you start the band Bush?
Well, it's a long story. I mean, dude, Bush has been like the worst last. My whole life, I've hated having the last name Bush.
Really?
Like my, yeah, I don't. I'm a lot
even
of
pre, even pre.
Yeah, well, a lot of people
George.
Don't know. I mean, you. I think you know, but my real name is Janosch. My mom named me after a Hungarian friend that helped her through her pregnancy before I was born. So she named me after him. And being named Janosch in Santa Cruz, California, in the 70s was kind of normal. But you know, somehow Janosch turned into Janosch. It turned into. Somehow, I was in fifth and sixth grade, my nickname was No Nukes, because I was like the hippie kid,
and literally it made me hate it.
So when I went from sixth grade to seventh grade, I changed it to John because Janosch is Jonathan, right. And blah blah blah.
Wait, so how's Janosch spelled?
J A N O S.
Oh yeah,
the J
Janosch.
Yeah, Janosch. You know, Janosch.
Like,
nobody never knew how to pronounce it right, so I was kind of like, fuck it. Let's go to John Bush. And then John Bush, I kind of always liked the one-syllable first name, one-syllable last name. But John Bush. Like, nobody ever called me John. I mean, I had Little John
for a
while.
When you have a name like that, people will call you by both names.
Yeah, and I liked it.
Yeah. No, I think it's great.
But, man, then I had to go through fucking 14 years of two awful presidents with the same last name.
Oh,
that stupid band Bush.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I never joined the military because I never wanted to be Private Bush. I mean, God forbid if I made it a career, got to Major Bush, that would be amazing.
Okay. I guess everything was not Zen.
No. But I like my name now. Like, John Bush doesn't bother me. But I have a hard time. Like, I keep thinking if I ever have kids, like, I have to worry about the name, you know? Like, I've always liked the name Rosie, but I was like, Rose Bush? That ain't gonna happen.
No, it's good, dude. Four letters is good.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, four letters. I back it.
You're the front of the alphabet. I'm Bayer, so it's like, you know, you're up there in school. You're at the top of the...
First person asked to do stuff.
Yeah.
Whatever. What
So let's go back there, dude. Let's go back to your origins in Santa Cruz.
Santa Cruz. God, if anybody's listening and knows Santa Cruz, it is the craziest town. It was a town that was like a real sleepy, nothing town until the 60s. And then when the summer kind of happened, summer of love and all that kind of happened, and when the summer of love started ending and all these people got into drugs and, you know, the Hells Angels started kind of ruining the scene and the scene got overpowered with violence and drugs, all these hippies fled, and they fled all around the bay. And Santa Cruz turned into this crazy hippie hick community because there's these weird mountains and there's real life hillbillies up in these mountains. And then it was like this surfer town and then all these hippies were there. And I swear to God, I feel like every single mother from San Francisco moved to Santa Cruz. Because when I grew up, out of the crew of like 20 of us, 25 of us, like maybe three of us had dads that were around.
Whoa.
Like it was all single moms raising children. And most of them were boys. It was this real, so it turned into this like, oh, it was such a weird town. Like I just think about growing up there and it seemed normal to me at the time because of movies and stuff like that. But it, like we had punk rock gangs. We had skinhead gangs. We had a mod gang. We had surfer gangs. We had like jock gangs. They're called the Oakley Boys because they all wore Oakley like blade sunglasses. And we had a British rocker motorcycle gang, you know, they were called the VRCC. It was a vintage rocker motorcycle club. And they were all like these 20-year-olds with greaser hair and leather jackets and Nortons and Triumphs. And like, it was like the weirdest thing. Now at retrospect, I look at it and like, and we all fought or got together and we were like two gangs would unify them against one gang. And then it was so weird. And just thinking about how, and then the whole Nazi skinhead thing happened, and it was like everybody, like Santa Cruz turned into this like traditional skinhead haven where traditional skinheads from all over California would move to Santa Cruz because we had a big gang called the Dover Arms Firm. It was so stupid.
When did you kind of start going to punk shows and that kind of stuff?
I had my older cousin Taffy. When I was like 12 years old, I had a neighbor, and my neighbor came over and was like, you want to go to live music? I have what's ticket. And I mean, it sounds like I'm bragging, but it's truth. The first show I ever got to go see was The Clash. I saw The Clash at the Civic Auditorium. I believe it was the Combat Rock Tour. I just remember it was a stage that had TVs all over the whole back of the stage. It was 1983.
Yeah.
The next day, I walked up to my mom. I was like, I got to go buy this record from The Clash. So I bought The Clash record. And I'm not even joking. I had like Frankenstein, The Wolfman, Ding book where you turn the pages. And then I had a Clash record. And my cousin came over. And she's like 3 years older than me. And she was from Austin, Texas. And she stayed with us for a summer. And she was like, came over, sitting in my room, looked, and she's like, The Clash? Well, that's my favorite band. She's like, are you serious? I'm like, yeah. She's like, oh my God, I got so much to show you. And she turned me on to punk music, like everything. Like she just turned me on to like so much
music.
And
how old was she?
She was probably 15 or 16.
Oh my God.
From Austin, Texas, you know?
Right.
Like she was like friends with the Big Boys and like the Big Boy, that band. And she would like, she turned me on to so much music. She turned me on to a radio station that was on at like Thursday and Friday at midnight that played all punk music to like 6 a.m. And when she left that summer, I remember she gave me a Sex Pistols record, a Ramones record, and I think a Damned record. I might have made up the Damned record, but she gave me a Sex Pistols record and the Ramones record for sure. And then a bunch of like mixed tapes that she recorded off the TV stuff, the radio station, and a Sex Pistols poster. The one that had Johnny Rotten dressed as a teddy boy.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was it, like that, you know. And then she kind of introduced me to some of her friends through that, like her punk friends. And then I kind of knew her punk friends from then. And then my mom got sick and I went to Sacramento for 2 years. My mom got cancer. It was a treatable cancer, but our grandparents lived in Sacramento and they said that they'll take care of us if we move there. So for like 2 years, I went to Sacramento and that was eighth grade and ninth grade. So I did, yeah, eighth grade and ninth grade. So like I was like the punk kid in my school. Like when eighth grade was, I was the only punk kid in my school. And then when I went to McClatchy High School, there was a couple other punk kids and I was like, oh, cool. And then I got kind of in the punk scene there. And then we moved back to Santa Cruz. That's when I kind of, well, instead of that, I kind of found oi music and got more into like skinhead stuff. And that was like pre-Nazis. It was just skinheads. It was punks and skins.
Right.
It wasn't a difference. But I was really into oi and I was really into all this music. And, you know, like I was like, I had that, you know, little man syndrome. So I wanted to be like tough. So I shaved my head, boots and braces and did that whole 9 yards. But still went to punk shows.
Seen some of those pics.
Yeah, and then went back to Santa Cruz, and then went, so the 2 years I was gone, this same kind of skinhead scene happened, and I met Joel Loya and this motley crew of hippie parents skinheads. It was just like my crew for the, you know, I mean, they're still my friends today.
Right. Do you remember what city it was that we met in?
I believe it was in San Francisco.
It wasn't? No.
I remember us hanging out at Mad Dog in the Fog in San Francisco. That's my first memory.
It was Salt Lake City.
Utah?
Yeah, you were with the Udders, and I think you guys were going east, and we were going west with Rancid.
Was that when we were with...
It was 94.
Were we on tour with God damn it.
You played, we all played together in Salt Lake.
Oh, with Rancid.
Yeah. So it was like the Goops, Utters, Rancid. And I feel like there was another band. I think maybe Chokebore was, no, not Chokebore. Somebody else was with us.
What was the Jack Grisham's second band?
Joy Killer?
Yeah.
Yeah, Joy Killer. Because it wasn't with them?
No, no, no. That was late. We did tour with them on that tour, but that was later.
I loved them.
Oh, my God. Their first, Joy Killer's first record was amazing. I mean, great. Jack is one of those people that is the creepiest, grossest, scariest human being I've ever known in my life, but I'm so happy he likes me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, that I'm friends with Jack Grisham. It's just, there's a part of me that's like, yes, Jack Grisham likes me. But I am petrified of him. The scariest people I know in punk rock are only scared of Jack Grisham.
I saw the Joy Killer when I was in high school. I was probably like 16. And he signed that first record. It was like when you're 16, you're like, I want to get autographs. And he signed it. And it's the most insane. He wrote all these like drums. He's like, are you in a band? And I was like, yeah, I just started my first band. He's like, let me give you some tips. He's like, drums got to sound chunka chunka. And he just writes like drums, chunka chunka. Guitar has got to be like blar blah. And he just wrote all this gibberish all over it.
God, do you still have it?
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, dude, we did like, I toured with those guys for like, couple weeks.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, that first record is great. If you're listening to this and you're not familiar.
That was the record they were touring, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, for real. They're awesome.
So
I don't remember that at all.
I'm pretty sure. I'm almost positive because I think you were doing merch for the Utters then.
Probably.
Fall of 94.
Yeah, that's all I did from like 1990 to 2001.
So how did that happen?
Yeah, how did that happen?
Swinging Utters? I think one of their first show ever was on my back porch, you know? I mean, Johnny Bunnell, the singer, Greg was part of the Dover Arms Firm crew that I was in. I knew him forever. Darius came in a little bit later, but Johnny Bunnell and Kevin Wickersham, the original bass player, they were like the kids that hung out with us that were like kind of into, we called them like suede heads because they wouldn't shave their head, but they hung out with us and they listened to kind of the same music. But they were like the guys who were like really into the Buzzcocks and the Undertones, right. You know, they, you know, those bands that, you know, as a, like a traditional skinhead were like, yeah, they're skinhead bands, but they weren't. They were just like, you know, weird pop bands at the same time that the Cockney Rejects were around and all those guys were around and it was still good music. But Johnny P. Bucks and the Swinging Utters, his nickname P. Bucks, I was with him, was either my graduation party or my 18th birthday party at my house. We got hammered. And he was known for getting hammered in penis pants. That was like kind of what happened. He did. And he went and fell asleep in his car and peed his pants. And we woke him up and he was just like, fuck, I'll just go. And we drove downtown and we went to Taco Bell. And we were ordering for the Taco Bell and he was paying for it. And the girl was like, did you jump in the ocean last night? He goes, nah, I beat my pants. And Greg turned to him and goes, Johnny P. Bucks. And it just stuck. And that was his nickname. I mean, not that many people call him that anymore, but no. That was his nickname for 20 solid years.
Right.
And the Swinging Utters, that was Greg's cat, was pregnant when we were just sitting around. It was Johnny P. Bucks and the Swinging Utters.
Really?
Dude, it's like, it's the worst name in punk rock. And they know it. And it was just like, I swear to God, we were hoping it'd be one of those names that got trans, you know, you just forget what it means.
Right.
Like Rancid. Like nobody thinks Rancid.
Right.
They think the band Rancid, not Rancid.
Right.
We were hoping that would happen, but it never did. People, like every interview you ever did, they're like, what's up with the name? You're like,
So this was, you were hanging in Santa Cruz?
Yeah, this was Santa Cruz.
Okay, because I associated them so much with San Francisco, I guess.
Well, it was, you know, I would say that we were the biggest band coming out of Santa Cruz. And then in the early 90s was when, you know, that's when, you know, it was alternative music was the cool thing. And, you know, we were going up to San Francisco every weekend and playing shows and, you know, I remember me and Max moved to San Francisco and the other guys still lived in Santa Cruz. So Max would drive to Santa Cruz or they would drive up to do band practice. And then we got signed to Fat Records, kind of started letting us use their rehearsal space. And then slowly the band all moved to San Francisco. And then, you know, New Red Archives signed us first.
Right.
I love how he calls us. Like I was such part of that band for so long. You know, everybody's just like, yeah, John Bush from Swinging Utters. Of course. Yeah. I'm all, yeah, I never learned how to play an instrument. I didn't even learn how to turn. I was the worst roadie of all time. I didn't have a driver's license. I didn't know how to tune a guitar. I could carry equipment and sell merch. And that's it.
What's crazy about that record, because I used to interview Johnny about it, is how many songs are on Streets of San Francisco?
Yeah, a lot of songs.
And they're all good.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
It's one of my favorite records.
Yeah, it's an amazing record.
I mean, like for like a punk record of, I mean, it was, you know, it came from the influence of all of us listening to Oi and that kind of music. You know, it's like Johnny wanted to be the singer of Stiff Little Fingers more than anything in the world. That was his just, I love Stiff Little Fingers.
It's good ambition.
And those were the bad, those days, those bands never came around. You never got to see those bands live. It was all just on record. We didn't, I mean, YouTube didn't exist. So you, everything you found was like weird VHS tapes somebody would bring back from Europe or randomness, you know? Yeah. So it was like, you know, we didn't really get the, you know, even the records were hard to find.
Yeah.
Like we had a record store in Santa Cruz called Logos that somehow magically had every record came through there. I have no idea. My whole, I still have records today. The store, the Logos closed this year in Santa Cruz. It's heartbreaking. And I took, you know, I still have all these records I was pulling on. They still have the Logos like price tag sticker on them. But I mean, like I found every Oi record, you know, the Sound of Oi, which one of the hardest records in the world to get for $1.99 there. You know, it's like that's, it was just the weirdest thing. Like it was only famous for jazz. They had like $3,000 jazz vinyl and had just these layers, like just floors of jazz and nothing. And then like two sections for punk. And it was like every record you're like, I'll buy this, I'll buy this, I'll buy this. And then like the next week it'd be a whole new cubby full of punk records. And you're like, I don't know where they're finding these, but I bought as many of them as I could.
I want, can I skip ahead a little bit? Because I'm curious. Like the era, maybe like Juvenile Product, working class, that era when sort of Green Day's getting signed, all these bands are getting huge. I mean, what do you kind of look back at that time? What was that like?
God, man, that was like, I think at like the '80s when I was like a punk in like the early '80s, it was scary. Like I think about like, you were constantly getting beat up by jocks. I mean, it's funny to think about that now. Cause like jocks are in the punk now. Yeah. You're like, you're, right. So weird. But back then you were like a punk rocker and jocks thought, we're going to kill you. Like you really had to walk around in packs and it was scary. And then the flip side of that is the punk scene was filled with creeps. Like there was just like, it was, you're constantly like, everybody was like taking acid. So it was like these weird weirdos would clump onto the punk scene because of like drugs and girls and they could be cool. They could be cool in this weird, the weirdos could be cool in a weird scene, I guess. That was really, so it was like really, I remember just a lot of fear and violence from like, 83 to 88. There's a lot of fear and violence. And then when I got kind of like, I was like, Nazi skinheads just got so big. I was like, fuck, I'm not shaving my head anymore. I don't want to deal with any of this anymore. So I'm just going to be me. Like, I'm just going to be me. And then like, me and Max moved to San Francisco. And then the punk scene was kind of growing. That's when we met Fat Mike. And we met like Chris Shiflett and the guys from No Use first. And then like the guys from Tilt and Screw 32. And like Davey Havoc and those guys from AFI. I mean, AFI was a bunch of fucking idiots when we first met them. That was their nick. That was their name. And then we started going to Berkeley and started hanging out all these like punk houses. And then, you know, Gilman Street opened up. I mean, they had The Farm, which was the old punk club in San Francisco that I saw like all the early 80s punk. And then there was like the Mav and Broadway had punk shows every once in a while. And then when Gilman Street opened up, it really turned into this community of punk, and it was like everybody supported everybody. There was no haters.
Did you ever see App Ivy?
Only at the Farm.
Okay.
I don't remember if they ever played the Gilman Street, but I saw them at App Ivy a bunch. But like it was this really fun community of band. I mean, maybe it was because we were in a band at that point, so it was like bands hanging out with bands. Oh, let's play a show at the Gilman Street, and then we all go to the Screw 32 house, or we all go to the AFI house, or we all, you know, or we, if you came in the city and you played the Night Break or anywhere or the Bottom of the Hill, our house was the party house, and it turned into this really like fun family. And it was like punk was kind of cool then, so it wasn't dangerous, you know, like. The dudes were cool enough, or if the guys were creepy with girls, we'd be like, get the fuck out of here. Like, no, we don't have to put up with your nonsense anymore because we're all 21 now. We don't need you to buy us beer. it was definitely just, me and Max would go see live music 5 days a week. 5 days a week, we'd go to a show. And, you know, the other 2 days we were probably too hungover, just like, I need sleep, or had the stupid jobs we had just to pay the rent and get by. I lived in San Francisco. I was paying $180 a month rent, struggling to pay it.
What were you doing?
What do you mean? Oh,
to make money.
God, I worked at. I was a bar back at Mad Dog in the Fog. I was a bar back at Club Deluxe, which was at that time swing music was huge.
Right.
So me and Max were like the punk kids that hung out at the hot swing club. That was so weird. Literally just made just enough money and a job that I could quit, go on tour, come back, find another job like that.
Right.
Go on tour, come back, find another job. I mean, I did everything from working at like a place called the People's Cafe, like prepping salad mix. Yeah, did anything.
I mean, did things change when all these major labels are throwing money around and stuff, or you were kind of in a your own?
Things change. I mean, it definitely, like, those, you know, there's definitely some bands got signed. You know, there was definitely a time where, like, everybody was really tight and really, really close. And then people, you know, started getting those big deals. And then the whole sellout thing kind of got thrown around. And I never really believed in the sellout. I was like, isn't this the goal of it? But I definitely know some people that went real rock star. Like, you know, I don't blame anybody for selling out to make money playing music. That's the dream. Sure. I do blame people that were your friends that all of a sudden they're like, oh, I can go hang out with this guy instead. So, you know, screw you. I'm like, you've been sleeping on my goddamn floor for the last 3 years, and now you're too cool to get me a backstage pass or get me into the show or just fucking say hello.
Right.
So I saw a lot of that starting probably 97, 98. You started seeing the crew, the family start kind of like splitting up. I mean, I always say, like, I saw it started on the Warped Tour. Like, I remember when the first three Warped Tours, it was like everybody was together.
Right.
It was like Kevin was like, here's the beer. Like 1995 Warped Tour, some of the best friends I have today are the people I met on that tour.
Who was on that tour, you remember?
Lisa Brownlee?
Lisa Brownlee wasn't on the tour yet.
You don't hear about Lisa being predated on Warped Tour very often.
If she was, she wasn't who she wasn't. I knew Lisa Brownlee from San Francisco.
Okay.
Like, she used to hang out at the bars that I worked at. So I knew, gosh, I remember it. Before I knew her, I was like, who's that girl? Oh my God. She's the hottest chick of the world. Yeah. And then now I know her. I'm like, Lisa, I can't believe I've known you for 30 years. But no, that was like, it was, God damn it. It was L7, No Use for a Name. I'm trying to think of the big L7, No Use for a Name. Jesus.
Was Sid on that tour?
No, Sid wasn't on it.
It was the second Warped Tour. Wasn't the first Warped Tour in 94?
Nope, 95.
It was?
Yeah. God damn it. I'm totally blanking names right now.
Brad, if only you had a computer right in front of you.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Warped Tour 2005. I cannot believe I'm blanking names.
I mean, dude,
right now.
1995, I don't remember a lot.
Yeah. It's like Sick of It All was on it.
Okay.
I'm totally not remembering the headliners. That's what's making me crazy.
Ooh, No Doubt.
No.
A little band called.
Were they on the first
Sublime?
One?
Sublime? It says, yeah, 95.
Sublime was on it. Yeah, Sublime was on it. They were one of
the Deftones, Face to Face, No Use, Sick of It All, Guttermouth, Swingin' Utters, Tilt.
Yeah. Who were the headliners? It was like,
let me see.
God damn it. I am just brain farting away because I cannot remember. There's two headliners that.
No Doubt and Sublime, it says. This was, I don't know if this is the whole tour.
No, it was.
This is Orlando.
Oh, it's going to make me crazy.
Oh, Orange 9 was on?
Yeah, Orange 9 Millimeter. Oh, that's where I met Chaka the first time.
And Civ both.
Really? Civ was on? I don't remember Sabina at all.
Quicksand.
That's who I couldn't remember. God damn it. Quicksand.
Wow, all three of those bands were on Warped
Quicksand
Tour.
Quicksand was the headliner. Wow. And on that tour is when Sublime started getting big. Okay. So they kind of started off as like low, and by the end of it, they were on the top.
Yeah.
And their photographer at the time was this guy, Pat Conlon. And me and Pat Conlon became, I mean, one day I met Pat Conlon, Chris Shiflett, me and Max we didn't steal a keg, but there was like this corral zone where all the kegs where everybody could have beer. But there was like this big bunch of bushes behind the corral zone. So we just moved a keg over into these bushes and started, and so we didn't have to wait in line or deal with this shit. We just had our own secret keg over here. And, like, you know, Chris Shiflett and Pat Holland are today one of my closest friends.
That's wild.
I have a photo of all of us, like, around the keg, like, yay! So weird.
How did you sort of meet Fat Mike and kind of become involved with that stuff? Was that that was through the Udders?
It was through the Udders. It was, God, I can't even remember how it happened. It was almost like this weird Jerry Seinfeld, like, where Mike was courting Swingin' Utters, trying to get him off New Red RFI to come there. And Max and Mike became really good friends. And I remember somehow Max went home to DC or something like that. And Mike called him. He says, pre-cell phones. Mike called the house and was like, hey, is Max there? I'm all, no. He's like, who's this? I'm all, John. He's like, hey, John, what are you doing? I'm in the city and I'm kind of just, I was going to go see a movie or something. And I was like, all right. And then all of a sudden, like, me and Mike became really good friends. And it's like, I think that maybe this is my perception. Like maybe I was one of the only guys that wasn't like fan struck by Mike.
Right.
And I kind of just was like, what up? And this was kind of up for anything. I mean, I was definitely always like down the tri, like, I'll go there. I'll eat that. I'll try that. I'll do this. Like, none of that scared me too much. And I think he kind of liked to have some, like, weird normal friend. Even though I don't think I was normal, but it's really weird. Like, I think about me and Mike's relationship, and everybody was like, oh, yeah, you're like, he always says you're his best friend, and you're the most honest person to him, which has been cool and hard at the same time.
Yeah. And but your apartment got mentioned in a song.
He did. He wrote two songs about me.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Pretty weird.
And you're the official bartender of the first in the Gimme Gimmes.
I bartended in the Gimme for the Gimme Gimmes.
What was the first year you did that?
God, I don't remember. 2000?
Okay.
I did it twice. The 2 years that the Gimme Gimmes with the bar mitzvah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what's fun. That gig? You're on it's on wheels?
Yeah, they made a road case that unfolded into a bar. And my job every day was to wake up, restock the bar. I set it up for an hour before the show and for like half an hour after the show. And I bartended on stage. I mean, it was awesome. I was like the most loved man on the Warped Tour. Yeah.
What's do you get good tips when you're
on Warped? I can't remember how much they paid me. They paid me reasonably well. Like, I think I got paid $100 a day, $700 a week,
right,
plus all expenses. And then I was making about $200 to $300 to $400 a day in tips.
Holy shit, really?
And for a dude, like, you know, back in the Warped Tour days, it was like every stitch of clothing I wore was like Vans, NoFX shorts, No Use for Name shirts, you know.
He had no overhead.
Nothing. I mean, I remember when I got paid, Mike, to be a dick, paid me in ones. I remember I got off the tour with like $4,000 in ones.
No way.
And I was just like, geez. And I had a giant sock full of change. I don't remember why I had a giant sock full of, like, I had like $500 in like quarters, dimes, and nickels in a giant white tube sock stretched to hell.
Wasn't there a show on Warped Tour where Mike threw a bunch of dollars into the audience or something? Was that?
Yeah, that was.
I'm trying to
somebody
remember.
they got screwed over. I forgot what some. I think it was like some other band was supposed to play and then backed out. And Mike was just like, well, you should only pay this much to see NoFX. I'm giving everybody $5 back. So he handed it all the kids five bucks each to apologize for some band backing up.
Okay, yeah, it's vaguely familiar.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Mike used to be a lot funnier until he got obsessed with politics.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I guess we all do that. We're all adults. But, you know, when he was just silly, when the NoFX was a silly band, I had a lot more fun.
That's pretty much true all across the board. Music and politics is a tough one to mix up.
I think it's a little of that. And I also think that it's, you know, growing up is a trap. And it's like you feel like you start turning adult. And it's like, you're like, why do I care about this? Like, I never cared about this my whole life. And then, like, now I'm 47 years old and like I'm paying attention to politics. Fuck, I don't care. I mean, honestly, I don't care. Like, I wake up every day and just try to be the best dude I can be. And I want to hang out with my friends and I want to eat good food and I want to laugh and joke around. So why do I care? But I do. And I can't stop. And then all of a sudden I'm talking about it. And God, it's boring.
Yeah, I wish you could be like, I mean, I remember when I was a kid and I might get pissed off or upset about Ronald Reagan for a minute. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then I forgot about it.
Yeah, you can't escape
and
it.
And I started
now.
Thinking
you
about girls.
You can't escape it.
Yeah.
I guess that's true. But I think it also, it's to your point, it's partly growing up. You get older.
I guess. I don't know. I mean, you know, I spent probably 1991 till 2000 traveling the world, getting drunk and taking photos with my buddies and laughing. And then all of a sudden I was like, I gotta get my shit together. I gotta get a real job. And, you know, I went into the business that I'm in now and I got married. And now I'm like, what the fuck did I do that for?
Because you might have died. Not everybody has Mike's
metabolism. Yeah, but I would have lived, brother. I would have lived.
How did you you had always kind of worked at bars and stuff?
Always. I mean, almost my whole life I've worked in the bar industry. And I always say I did because it gives you, the bartender world has changed now. Like, it used to be like a photographer. It's like you had to be a skilled photographer. And then digital photographer came. And now everybody's a photographer. And I feel like, I remember when I came to the city, Johnny T wouldn't let me bartend for 2 years. I had to work for him. Right. I had to be a bar back and learn the trade and blah, blah, blah. And then I became a bartender.
Yeah.
And now anybody's a bartender. You can just go take a course, or you can just learn how to make a Jack and Coke. And
he respects the trade.
But, it was a vagrant's job. Like, I could bartend. I mean, I've bartended in cities all over the world. Like, you know, when I would travel, I would work and then travel on my own. And, you know, I'd go to a bar. I'd be in, like, an island in Thailand, and I'd sit at this bar, Sam and Dave's, and I'd sit there. Oh, I'm a bartender from New York. Oh, really? Blah, blah, blah. Oh, you know any drinks? Blah, blah, blah. Oh, I'll get behind the bar. Oh, here's a Cosmopolitan, New York Cosmopolitan. And I'd sit at the bar. And then by the end of the night, the owner would be like, dude, how long are you sticking around for? You want to bartend here for the next... As long as you're here, I can't pay you, but you can give tips and I'll feed you. And we got a room in the hotel. You can stay at for free.
Fuck.
And I'd be like, all right. And I'd do that for a month. And then I'd get a little bored or start to feel like I'm wearing out my welcome and be like, all right, I'm going to move on. And then I'd go to, Japan and work at a bar in Japan, or I'd go to Australia, or and then I'd always come back and always get a bartending job back. And
what year did you move to New York?
The end of 95.
Right.
Right after that first Warped Tour. But, I was still going on tour swinging udders. Like, I would fly. I'm still going between Swinging Utters, the Warped Tour, Tour with NOFX. I was based in New York, but I was, I don't think I was settled in New York for a long time. I mean, I lived on Ethan's couch for 2 years almost.
When did Max move here?
Maybe 4 years later, probably 2000, I'd say, 2001.
I mean, had you always wanted to have your own bar or restaurant? Was that always a dream of yours? Or?
I always wanted to. I always, in the back of my mind, thought retirement would be me opening a little Irish bar and just running that Irish bar. And I remember we opened up Thistle Hill Tavern. We thought, I was like, this is it. This is what I'm doing. And then we met my other business partner, Dale Talday, and then we opened up Talday. And then we opened up another Talday. And then all of a sudden, I'm a restaurateur, and I'm like, which I am very, very proud of what I do. I'm very proud of the things that I've created. I like the ride I'm on. It's definitely been interesting. But, man, I miss touring. I miss my friends. I miss just, I don't give a fuck. I miss laughing and going nuts.
What would you do if me first got, another Warped Tour and asked you to come?
I'd have to think about it.
as a restaurateur, how do you feel about Yelp? Does it drive you insane?
It's the worst thing in the entire world.
I love talking about
this. Extortion artists.
Yeah.
They are. What Yelp will do is they'll come to you and be like, hey, we love your restaurant. You mind if we put it on Yelp? And you're like, I don't care, sure. And then about 3 months in, they'll be like, hey, so you can get ultra advertising if you pay us $500. You're like, no, that's cool. And they're like, oh, okay. And then they put all your bad reviews on top and bury all your good reviews in the bottom.
No way.
Yeah, really? Someone's working on a documentary exposing this part of Yelp.
And then if you give them the $500, they'll put all your good reviews on top and bury all your bad reviews in the bottom. And it's like,
yeah, that is extortion.
Yeah. And it's one of those situations. And then I think people that go on Yelp, it's like, get a fucking life, people.
Yeah.
Okay, you know what I do when I go to a restaurant that wasn't very good? I just don't go back.
Yeah.
And I tell my friends, I didn't like that place. You could try it. I didn't like it.
I catch myself doing it sometimes. I'm like, why do I care what these strangers think about this? Like, you know what I mean?
Well, I like the idea of Yelp for a moving company, or a doctor.
Well, the idea of the working model is great. I mean, but
I think if you had to put your real name, I don't pay attention to anything you don't have to put your real name to.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Because that's the thing. It's like, I can be Joe Schmo 666 and
say anything
and just be like, John Bush sucks. I hate that fucking guy. I could tell you some stories. You know what I mean? And everybody's like, do you hear about this guy? This is Joe Schmo 666. He really knows John Bush. And I can make up a million things. I could just complain. There's just haters out there. And the only way they can make themselves feel better is shitting on other people.
Right. And they're the ones with the most time, the haters.
Yeah.
I don't have time to eat at a restaurant and then go home and write a fucking 9-page Yelp review about what a crappy meal I had. And, I think that's a weird sign of the times too. We're in that time where I think it's all people my age that have kids. And then, I think a lot of people maybe came from abusive homes or single parent homes. And they're like, when I have a kid, I'm going to do it right. I'm going to treat my kid like the angel that he deserves and blah, blah, blah. But they don't realize that they're creating these little monsters that have no idea the word no, or you can't. Or why not? Or you can't do that to me. You're just like, no, 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 no. This is the fucking real world. You know, it's a sign, and this is also making me sound very old. I get it. I know that I sound like, I remember my dad talking about this kind of nonsense and me like, chill out. And now I'm like, yep, now I've turned into my father where I'm just like, I grew up in a world where sticks and stones will break your bones, but words will never hurt you. So I'm like, all right, that makes sense. Yeah. But not today, man. Words are the enemy.
Yeah.
Watch, we'll use words for defense, fist, like everything. It's like the idea of getting, I grew up with my whole life being scared of getting punched in the face. Watch what you say, you're going to get punched in the face. People don't have that anymore. They're like, punch in the face? I'll sue that guy. He punches me in the face, I'll sue him. You're like, oh, Jesus.
There's a lot of people that need a punch in the face in this world.
I'm telling you, I'm not a big advocate for violence, but they're, you know, people forget that we're animals, and they forget that we're so different. Like, I think, you know, people gravitate towards people they like because we're kind of the same. Like, I like people that have the same values as me and same things that think like me. And we become friends, and like, because we all are the same. But man, I meet people, I'm like, what the fuck is wrong with that guy? Like, that person's insane. And they are insane.
Yeah.
And he probably thinks I'm insane. So we just stay away from each other.
Yeah. Do you like, we were talking about jujitsu on the way here. Mm-hmm. You came from there. I mean, how, do you feel like that's kind of helped you? Or do you enjoy doing that? Is that a good outlet for you?
Yeah, I mean, I, you know, if I'm sounding like a violent person, I forgive me, because I'm not a big brawler. I just grew up I grew up in a time where fighting was very normal. I've always done a martial art. I've done a martial art mostly because I've always been kind of hyper. I also had, as I said, the little man syndrome. I also got beat up a lot when I was a kid, so I took martial arts, and then now in my later years, I continue to do martial arts because running on a treadmill. Or lifting weights is lame and boring. So I found jujitsu about 7 years ago, and it's just obsessing. I think about it all the time. It's like a chess game in your mind, and one of the best physical workouts I've ever had. And it definitely calms me down. Like, I used to like to go, if a fight broke out, I was like, oh, let's go see. Now if I break out, I'm like, boring. Jesus, let's go. And, you know, the thing I like about jiu-jitsu the most is it's like, it's a martial art that you're not pulling your punches. It's you're really playing simulated murder. You know, it's
right.
you get into a situation where somebody can break your arm, break your leg, put you to sleep and kill you until you tap. And then they let go. And you tap hands and do it again. And it's like this thing where it's like, you know, you're putting your life in these guys' hands. I mean, my friends from jiu-jitsu are like, I barely hang out with them in the outside world. But if there was a problem, they'd be some of the first people I'd call. If I need help moving, I'd call the guys from my jiu-jitsu studio before I'd call you guys.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Me and Brad probably wouldn't be that helpful.
Yeah, there's just this meditation about it that's just been really, really fun. Like, I feel like that I'm a like CrossFitter or a vegan now when I talk about jiu-jitsu, because I'm like, everybody should do
it. Well, it's probably the kind of thing where it's like you have to be so focused, your brain isn't going to all these other places. You're really concentrating.
It turns off all my daily day. Like, for, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours a day when I'm doing jiu-jitsu, I'm thinking about, how am I going to get out of this problem? Like, problem solving, you know, it's under duress.
Yeah.
And it's awesome and fun. And especially when you get to a point where it starts working. And you see, like, you see yourself using jiu-jitsu, and you're relaxing, and you're breathing, and, like, you know, it's like, I still really enjoy rolling with white belts now, because I see that, I remember that. I tell white belt, everybody that comes in their first class, you know, after the first class, I sit down with them, and I say, take a big deep breath, and remember, every single person in this room, including John and my instructor, have been exactly where you are today, and I guarantee you it gets funner. And usually people are really excited. And the jiu-jitsu, the hardest thing to learn how to do is relax and breathe. It's a lazy man sport. You're doing the least amount of work you can to put somebody to sleep. And everybody should do it. It's
your
funnest.
Religion.
It's fun. It's not a religion. It's because there's definitely some schools that turn a little cultish. I've seen a lot of martial arts, I've seen this like weird cult mentality to martial arts. And I hated that.
Yeah.
You know, I think jiu-jitsu is fun. And it's, I mean, I'm one of those lucky guys that travel still enough where I pack a gi, and I, you know, most towns I'll walk, you know, I'll look up at school and I'll walk and I go, hey, my name's John Bush. I train at these schools, you know, my instructor's this guy. I'm living here for the next couple months, or I'll be coming here a lot and I just want to train. And they're like, open arms, come on in. Great to have you. And you get to learn something new from everybody.
So I'm going to change the subject real quick. All right.
Sure, bro.
Uh-oh.
We have a little segment that we do on the show called Mystery Friend.
And oh, did you see someone tweeted at us? They're working on a theme song.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry.
Looking forward to
I didn't respond to that. You can.
I responded.
Brad responded.
I sent him
an
email.
Please send it to us.
Yeah, maybe we'll have it in time for this episode.
Never know.
Mystery Friend is we go to a friend of yours, we ask them for like a question to get something for you to talk about. And then, and you need to tell, you know, you need
to elaborate. Do I have to figure out who the friend is?
Yeah, you elaborate on the story first, and then you have to tell who the friend is.
All right. It better not be Max, because that's too easy.
That's pretty obvious.
That does seem pretty obvious.
Tell us about Cynthia from New Age Hippie Aid Circus.
Cynthia. Jesus Christ. The New Age Hippie Aid Circus. I can't believe you know somebody that knows about that. Oh, Jesus. I don't even know where to begin.
Nice work, Brad.
God, I don't even know what friend could have brought that up. You don't know James Rotano. That's the only person I can think of that knows who that is.
Tell the story. Anyway,
so the New Age Hippie Aid Circus. Jesus, this is going back to like the early 80s when I just got back to Santa Cruz. I think it was James Rotano. No, it was Gardner. So my buddy Gardner got thrown out of his house by his parents, and he was probably 15. And he just got a job and had to find an apartment. And he found an apartment with this woman, Cynthia. God, I wish I could remember her awful nickname we had for her. It's so mean.
That wasn't it. I didn't say it.
No, the Hippie AIDS Circus. That's a whole nother. That was her friends. So anyway, so Gardner gets this apartment in the west side of Santa Cruz. And it was like, you know, a real two bedroom apartment. Like it was just like a place. And of course, Gardner was like, I'm having my friends over. And so Gardner's friends are like boots and braces, skinny guys.
Right.
They were just like beer chug. And Cynthia was, you know, a little overweight. Nice. And she was like, whatever. But she would bring her friends over. And her friends were these crazy hippie dudes and just girls and just hippies. They would like play bongos and smoke weed and just like dreadlock, like hippies. And we started calling them the New Age Hippie Aid Circus because they were just this crazy group of people. But so you go, so like on Fridays and Saturdays, these, like at the end of the night, these groups, a group of skinheads would come over to this apartment and these groups of hippies would come over to this house. And we'd all just smoke, like literally, like the skinheads would all hang out in the kitchen and the hippies would all hang out in the living room. Hippies would be smoking weed and we'd all be drinking beer and listening to music. And like there was no hatred or anything. Like we just thought they were funny old hippies. But every once in a while, somebody from our crew would sleep with a girl from their crew. And it just turned, and then like, if you slept with one of the girls, you got a name for we named all these hippies, like Falou, the flute player, and Pajama Jim. And like, there was like, we nicknamed all these, like hippies would hang out at the house. And I remember like, James O'Tonnell slept with one of the hippie girls. Ooh, I probably shouldn't have said his last name, but whatever. And so he was Micah, the knife thrower of the, you know, we were all like teenagers being silly. And that's funny. I haven't thought about that. That was like the first time one of our friends had their own apartment.
Okay. Yeah, that's huge.
Yeah.
Who do you think would have asked you about that?
I have no idea. That's the really the weird part, because that is such an obscure. The funny part about Cynthia, too, is that everybody slept with Cynthia.
Did you?
I did. And then, like...
You guys were, like, 15.
Yeah. Everybody slept with her. Like, it was just, like, one of those things where I just woke up.
It was a
like,
rite of passage.
Like, yeah. I mean, at 15, it was just, like, yeah. Anybody that wanted to have sex with me, I was just, like, yes! Life is... It's real. I wasn't proud of the moment at the time. But like, 5 years later, we ran into Cynthia in San Francisco, and she was gorgeous.
Really?
Like, she blossomed late. And she was, like, just... We were all, like, holy... Cow, look at, and then I tried to date her, and she was like, "Nah." I was like, "Damn it,
too late."
I know.
All right,
that's so weird.
Do you think you know who it is?
I mean, is it somebody from New York?
This person actually gave me 3 questions.
Well, give me the other two.
I'll give you the next one, and maybe this will help. Right. But you got to tell the story. I think I know this story. Your first wetsuit.
It's not helping me. Oh my God. That's a really good story. I told this, I don't remember why. This story came to me once again, me trying to like bang some hot girl. And she was like, tell me the most embarrassing story of you. And I sat there for a second. I was like, okay, I got a really embarrassing story for you. And I told this story to this girl. And then all of a sudden, it was like my new favorite story to tell. When I was a little kid, and this is probably when I was 10 or 11, I was little, like Oscar little. Like I was right. A little scrawny kid. And like I had like, they had O'Neill Surf Shop. And Mr. O'Neill was like a patron saint of surfing in Santa Cruz. So he would give all the poor kids, like he'd fix up an old board. He'd give you, a wetsuit that fit you. He was a really cool. And he gave me an old board, so I had a board. And then he gave me like a spring suit, which is just basically a shirt, like a wetsuit shirt. Right. And the Pacific is freezing.
Yeah.
But all my friends had full suits. In Santa Cruz, you really had to have a full suit to surf, or you were just like surfing, freezing. So I was just like, I need a full suit. I think this was sixth grade. It must have been sixth grade. So maybe I was a little older. But I remember I was just like, Mom, I need a – and it was $50 for a full suit. For a used full suit, those days, $50, which now seems like I got $50 in my pocket right now, but then it was a lot of money. So I spent like, and my mom was like, if you can make half, I'll pay the other half. So I spent a whole summer doing everything. I mean, saving pennies.
Right.
I'd mow lawns for 25 cents. I would do, scrap everything I could do for like 3 months to save up $25. I saved up $25. My mom gave me $25. We went to the Santa Cruz flea market. It used to be at this drive-in movie theater. And I searched all day for what? And I'm so small, it's really hard to find a suit. I'm telling you, all day I tried on 500 wetsuits. Never fit me. I was getting desperate and sad. And oh, I was so miserable. And finally, like towards the end, I find this amazing suit that was like all black. Had yellow lightning bolts down the sleeves and down the legs. Totally awesome. Put it on. It fit me. I was like, I can't believe it. I can't believe how psyched I am right now. So get home. Next day, we all went surfing before school at Cowles. And I put the suit on. Back in those days, you'd put the suit on and tie it around your waist to ride your bike. You'd only put the pants on. So I get up to the guy. I see my friends, and like Mark Goodrich and Mario Escobar and these guys. And we're like, dude, you got a suit. Ah! High fiving everybody. We're all looking at the waves. Y'all got our boards. And we're like, all right, let's go. And I pull up my suit and I zip it up. And I remember I looked over at Mark Goodrich and he looked at me and his eyes are like this big. And he just starts laughing. I'm like, what? And then I look around and everybody starts laughing. And everybody's laughing at me. And I'm just sitting here going, what? 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 And then Mark comes up to me. He's like, dude, that's a girl's suit. I'm like, what are you talking about? And he goes, it's got boobies. And it has boobie indents on it. So a woman can put it on and put, like, it had, like, extra things on the chest, had these boobs. And there was, like, a bunch of old surf. I mean, there's guys in Santa Cruz that called me Little Girl was my nickname for so long with some of these old surfers in Santa Cruz. I mean, I tore this suit off me in 1 second and threw it in the ocean. Like, that's how and ran home crying and was like,
oh, that's
devastated. I mean, I never got another wetsuit. I think that was almost the end of my surfing career. I was just
you
like,
you could be a pro surfer by now.
Oh, I mean, Zach Acker and Nate Acker and Sean Barron. I mean, those were my friends. And now they were all super pro surfers. And I was just like, fuck surfing. I'm punk rock beard girls. God damn it. I was, it's still, there's a little part of it when I tell that story that it's like, it hurts my soul. Like,
I feel a little sorry for that.
It was one of the worst moments of my life.
So that doesn't help you as far as who the mystery friend could be?
That doesn't. I told that story a lot.
Yeah. What's this, the third one?
The
What's
third question one? You actually already addressed, which was Johnny Peabuck's, how to get his name.
Is this a New York friend or a California friend?
Cali.
Darius?
No. Do, 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 do.
You got to give John another clue.
Yeah, the new age hippie AIDS circus is so random. He has to be somebody from Santa Cruz. But
so, yeah, you've already said his name during this podcast.
It's not James Ottano?
No.
Joel Loya?
Yeah.
Ah, okay. Yeah, well, Joel is part of that circus, too. That's funny. Yeah, Joel Loya was the king of the skins back in the day.
Yeah, that's hilarious.
So, John, what's your sort of, like, situation like now? Like, what are you working on? What's your kind of day-to-day?
Man, my life has turned into reading emails and going to meetings. And yeah. It's fucking garbage.
But, so let me recap because, yeah, your new career post Post being a roadie and Post being a bar, the coolest bartender in New York City.
I did win Best Bartender in New York 2004.
Yeah.
Timeout. Best Bartender of the Year.
So
won an iPad, and it was like that was when iPads were brand new, and I was like, look at this thing.
Nice.
Look gnarly.
So you started this with one you started out with Thistle Hill out in Brooklyn. And I've always attributed your success to you guys opened a bar in the right place at the right time.
We did at the time, but then that neighborhood changed a lot.
Right.
That neighborhood turned, it was Park Slope, Brooklyn back then. It was kind of just a sleepy little Irish neighborhood.
And you opened a tiny little spot with food
and a bar.
And it blew up. You paid back all your debtors in one quarter of the time.
That's not true, but we were making money and paying people back.
Oh, okay.
We didn't pay people back until we actually sold the building.
Oh, okay. But it happened much faster than you expected.
Yeah. I mean, the buzz happened a lot faster.
So you guys, I mean, you were already and then you opened your second spot before you hooked up with Talde, right?
Nope. Second spot we opened with.
Oh, it was. Okay. All right.
And then we opened up, you know, a bunch of spots. I mean, it's great. As I said, I'm very proud of what I do, and people say I'm really good at it, and that's awesome. I'm just turning into an adult. That sucks.
You had to do it sometime, man.
Did I? I knew people decided never to.
No, I had kids, and that's the way I turned it around.
If you can do it, I guess anybody can do it.
Everybody, I guess, has to be an adult at some point.
I know. I'll never forget when you and Catherine used to not say, we're not together. I don't know what you're talking about. We're not dating. I'm never gonna get married.
Yeah,
we're never gonna have kids.
You're in denial.
Yeah,
but I like what I do. I just, this New York City's just changed so much that it's not the city that I fell in love with. Like, you know, up to about 5 years ago, I thought I was gonna be here forever. And for the first time in the last couple of years, I'm like, I gotta get the fuck out of here.
Well, at this point, you are getting out. You're opening places outside of New York.
Yeah. I mean, I like to travel. I mean, luckily, because of work, I still get to travel a bunch. I'm going down to Miami on Monday. Every time I hear myself complain, I'm like, shut the fuck up. You're doing fine. Things are good. Stop complaining.
I mean, yeah, the curse of an interesting life, as they call it, right?
Well, your life never seems as interesting to you, though. I feel like in general.
I guess. I mean, when I was traveling a lot, you know, my biggest claim to fame is I've been to like 68 countries. You know, I've lived in a lot of other countries. I really got to see a lot of the world. And I remember being like, okay, but that's not enough. My big joke used to be is like, I drank through my 20s. I traveled through my 30s. I'm going to work my ass off through my 40s so I can travel through my 50s so I can drink through my 60s. Like, I want to.
It's a good plan.
You know, and I'm still kind of on that path. And I got to remember that, you know, I'm 7 years into my 10-year plan, which is pretty good.
Speaking of travel, talk about your photo career, especially in the Middle East.
The photo career was super fun. I never made a single dime taking photos, but I got to go everywhere. It was all a big fat Mike thing. I remember having a meltdown on tour and just being like, you know, it's hard when you're like the buddy of the band from the beginning and you kind of felt like you were part of the band. And then one day, all of a sudden, somebody tells you, you're not in this fucking band. You know, you work for me. Yeah, when your best friend that you traveled with for, you know, all over the world for 5 years, living in the dirt, all of a sudden goes, you're actually my employee, not part of this band.
Right.
Was heartbreaking for me. And, I remember just being like, okay, now I gotta find something else to do. And I was having like kind of a panic attack about it. And Fat Mike pulled me aside and was like, well, I just don't know what to do. I need to figure out something else to do. I need to just tell you blah, blah. And he was just like, when do you become a photographer? I always had a camera. I always took pictures. He's like, be a photographer. You know, the Warped Tour needs photographer. Like, we need photography. And I was like, I don't even know where to begin. He's like, well, come on next tour with us and be a photographer. And we're not going to pay you, but, you know, we'll give you a bunk on the bus. And if you take any good photos, we'll buy them from you. So that kind of just turned into a career of me just spending, I don't know, probably 5-6 years really kind of trying to be a photographer. It was super fun.
But how did like the Iraq thing happen?
The Iraq thing happened when, I think it was, I can't remember what band, one band went to Iraq and played on an aircraft carrier. And Fitzjoy, which is the old tour manager, did that tour. And then when he made some connections on that tour, and they were like, okay, we're looking for bands that want to come in, go in country and play these USO shows, which is like you go out to these forward operation bases all over Iraq and just entertain the troops. I mean, these poor kids are just sitting in a puddle of mud, literally.
Right.
Bored as shit with nothing to do. And a band will show up and we're here to play for you guys. And, you know, we'll bring a bunch of fake beer, which was so lame. They'd give us like, we'd come out with like non-alcoholic Budweiser, tasted like vegetable juice, and give it to all the guys. And the Vandals would play. Like kids that don't know who the Vandals were going nuts. But the kids that did know who the Vandals were going crazy. Oh my God. But so the Vandals decided to go because they just were adventurous and, you know, a little like, you know, super, a little pro America.
Right.
But Josh Freese, the drummer, was like, I ain't going to Iraq. So they got Byron from Pennywise. I was like, I'll go. And then the whole crew for the band was like, fuck that. I'm not going to Iraq. I'm not in this band. Like, no. So my buddy Carlos was the tour manager of the Vandals at the time. He's like, I bet you my buddy John, like they just needed another pair of hands, right. Really. They're like, my buddy John would go. And he called me up. And he was like, he called me up. We went there December 2003. He called me up. Like he's like, hey, we're going to Iraq in 4 days. I need to know if you can come in like the next hour. And I remember I called my girlfriend and she was like, don't go. And I called my mom. And she was like, don't go. And I called Carlos back and I was like, I'm coming. You know, I was like, you couldn't, you know, I'm one of the only people in my family that didn't serve in the military. And I was like, not that I ever had a guilt about that, but I was always like, I kind of want to see war. I kind of want to just see what it's like. And I'll never forget, just like you get all this stuff, and it's like they give you, I got issued a bulletproof vest and a helmet. And we were flying in Iraq, and my quote is, I was the only person there having a really good time. Like, I was just like, I was playing army, you know, I was hanging out with soldiers and, you know, going to shooting range and shooting guns and taking tons of photos. And we were flying around in Blackhawks every day, you know, like, getting a Blackhawk, we'd have one Blackhawk with all the equipment jammed into it, then one with all the band
that's
jammed into it.
That blows my mind. Amps and, in a Blackhawk helicopter.
And you'd fly, and then we'd unhook everything, we'd set it up. And luckily, for being a photographer, I just was taking photos. But, you know, got to go all over Iraq. And then, you know, had a couple days off where we got to go into Baghdad and, like, go some tours in the Baghdad. We went to the Baghdad Hotel. We spent New Year's Eve. We spent Christmas and New Year's Eve in Baghdad. It was pretty crazy.
How did the photos turn out from that trip?
Pretty good. Take some good photos from that. You know, it was definitely a different time of the war. It was right, you know, when the war was over, we won, right. And kind of before the insurgency. So it was a little safe, but you know, our base got mortared a bunch of times when we were there. Nothing too close. I'll never forget how scared we were in Kuwait. We flew into Kuwait, spent a night in Kuwait, and then went to Iraq. And that we were all just sleeping there, going, "What the fuck did we get ourselves into? Why are we? This is so stupid. We're going to a war zone for free." And I remember we coming back and sleeping in those same huts and at like a month later and just going, that was fucking amazing. Like, I want to do it again. Like, I would do it again. I mean, you know, just hang. It was like you're hanging out with guys our age.
Yeah.
And it was like all night long we were playing video games and eating at the mess and, you know, buying black market booze and talking to dudes. Like, you know me, I like to shoot the shit with anybody.
Yeah.
So, like, meeting people, talking to people, like, it was funny. It was a total obscure, weird adventure that, you know, and I got to see war in real life, you know. It was kind of scary and exhilarating and fun. And
you didn't have to shoot anybody.
And I didn't have to shoot anybody. I don't know if I shoot anybody. Shot a lot of guns, though. It was really fun. They were real fun.
But you didn't. What was the time that you were offered to blow up a cow?
Oh, that was in Cambodia. Yeah. I went to Southeast Asia for a long time. And when I was in Cambodia, somebody told me, like, you got to go to the shooting range. And I was like, okay. And I spent a whole day at the shoot, like, a couple miles out of the city, way out. And they were like, I have these photos of just, they just opened up this house with every gun you can think of. Like, what do you want to shoot? I started that one. And they just started pulling guns out and putting it on this rack. And I was throwing hand grenades. And I got hammered. I was super drunk. Like, I drank, like, I spent, and then they pulled out RPGs, and I was, like, shooting RPGs, and they're like, oh, for $80, you can blow up a cow. And I was just like, oh, I don't want to blow up a cow. Like, that's gnarly.
It is so wrong, man.
Yeah. Dude. It was one of those situations where I was just like, then I was like, no, I don't do that. I'll shoot a couple more rockets if I can shoot a couple more rockets. And like, yeah, totally. You know, there was like, I think it was $20 a rocket.
Wow.
But it was like, you know, you could shoot an AK-47, like three mags for $5. And then like, I was shooting like full belts of M60 for $10. It was throwing $5 hand grenades. Like, it was so funny too, because they were like,
the hand grenade thing is scary.
It was really scary. And if I wasn't a little in the bag, I probably wouldn't have done it. But it was throwing it in the water. Like, you were throwing it in this pond, which I guess must have been really deep. But like, you know, the guy was like showing me how to do it. And he's like, like this. And I was like, all right. And I pulled the pin. And they're like, no, wait. And they were fucking with me. I was like, what? What? And they're like, no, throw in the water. Like, oh. So I was like, just like those sissies. Like, and then I lied down on the ground, and then like they explode in the water. It's like up all over all of us. And they're just standing there drinking beers too. And I'm the only guy lying in the dirt. It was really embarrassing.
Dude, that's insane.
Yeah. It was pretty crazy. Like, I don't know why I did it. I just was like, fuck it. Let's get weird. You know, I climbed Mount Everest on that same trip. Well, I went to like base camp of Mount Everest just wearing Vans. People were like, this is the worst thing I've ever done in my life. You walk straight uphill for 12 days in Vans from
you would wear the dawn Vans till dusk. Out. How did you not wear through them?
Because it was dirt trails. It was cement, probably. I mean, they were pretty ruined by the time I got back. This is stupid. I remember like, I was there with my friend Lila Lee. You know Lila.
Yeah.
Lila Lee was living in Kathmandu, so I went and visited her. So after Christmas, we went up to, I spent another New Year's up on in Sulukumbo. And we walked up there together. And it was so funny when I was there. I was like, I was probably almost in Asia for a year at that point already. And I was like, I'd go up there and I'd meet all these fucking hippies that were like, they're studying the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And I'd just be like, is there any place around here that sells a USA Today? Like, like I gotta know how the Yankees are doing. Like, I need scores. And there's the new Star Wars movie's coming out soon. I gotta go home sooner than later. Like, and these people were just like, what the fuck are you doing here? Like, why are you here? And I was just like, I'm just here to drink beer and look at old stuff. I don't know. I just wanted to have experiences. I was never, none of my travels are like, were a soul searching adventure. Like, right. I would always say, I like me. I'm not trying to change. I just want to have some.
Just want to check some shit out.
Yeah, man. I have some new stories to tell.
All right.
Oh, I told you that would be good.
I never had a doubt. I never for a second doubted that John Bush would be a good podcast guest.
Did you guys know each other before?
Yeah. Yeah, we've hung out a bunch of times.
I realized when I opened the door and you were both there that, like, oh, I figured.
I saw him. He was walking when I was walking in, so we came in together. Yeah, yeah. We've hung out a lot of times.
I figured as much. Yeah. But then it didn't. But then I, you know, when I, like I said, the possibility was that you didn't.
I know everyone, Brad.
But you knew how to pronounce his last name, though.
I do. He has a very easy name to pronounce. And I only made one joke about the band Bush, which was not easy. Thanks to John for coming by. Check out his restaurants, I guess. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what to do to promote him. Like, John definitely doesn't need us to promote him.
Yeah, he's like opening places up all the time now. So, yeah, you know, he's partners with Tall Day. He's got a Tall Day in whatever. I don't know. Look it up.
Yeah, look it up.
If you want, we can put some links. We'll put some links. It's the least I can do for John.
Yeah, put some links. And if you're going to leave a review on Yelp, leave a nice one. You know?
Oh, God.
Don't be a dick.
Yeah, try to balance out some of that garbage
seriously.
Out there.
Get a life. Anyways.
If you want to leave us a review.
Nice. You can go to iTunes, leave us a 5-star review. Also, don't be a dick. Who goes to iTunes and leaves a podcast review, negative podcast review, which has happened to us? Only very rarely. But to me, it's this thing where it's like, like, you do this thing for free.
Everybody's doing it for free.
And it's like, just like, it's like, if I listen to a podcast and I don't like it, it's like John was saying about that. It's like, yeah, just don't listen to it again. Like, I don't think about it. I'm not like,
yeah, no, except, okay. Yeah, it's true. It's true. There's enough, like, the good stuff usually gets some press, even though there's a million podcasts.
I'm saying, like, yes, I agree. But like, kind of like what John said, it's like, if I hire a contractor to work in my house and rip me off for $5,000 or something, it's like, right. And like, that's like a form of recourse I have, like, sure. But like, yeah, to be like, I listened to this free podcast and like, I didn't like the sound of this guy's voice. Like, it's sort of like, really, you're going to sit down and take the time? Like, It's so...
It's a little nitpicky.
Our culture has just gotten...
Defocused.
Defocused. So let's all read Eckhart Tolle.
So refocus.
Refocus.
If you really want to focus, focus on patreon.com/goingofftrack.
I'm focusing on it right now.
Wait.
I'm focusing on it. I see early episodes. I see bonus outtakes. I see bonus... Wait, I...
New video of Jonah. No, that's not there yet.
This can't be true. Bonus Patreon only episodes?
Oh yeah, baby.
Oh yeah.
Full 30 minute episodes with just us talking about jury duty. Gear. We do have some crazy bonus. We have upcoming bonus episodes that won't be just me and Jonah and Benny talking shit about stuff.
But yeah.
We also have that.
So with that.
If you're still listening this late in this podcast, you probably would enjoy those.
You probably would enjoy those. So yeah, you can check those out. You can support us at patreon.com/goingofftrack. You can also shoot us $1 or $2, any amount. I believe there's no minimum amount. Ed from Beachlang has actually proved there's no minimum amount by sending us 69 cents and $4.20. So you can do that. Venmo.com/offtrack. We talked about iTunes. You can also tweet at us, blah, blah, blah.
And everything you can get through our website, goingofftrack.com.
Yeah, so if you go to goingofftrack.com, you can see it all. You can also... stream, listen to episodes there.
Yes.
Right?
All of them. They're all there from number one on.
From number one to number almost 300.
Almost.
We're getting there.
Wow.
It's been a wild ride, bro.
What a ride.
But yeah. anything else to add?
No, I'm exhausted.
All right. We are going to eat some Girl Scout cookies and we'll be back next week with more podcasting fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code Program.